content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We will begin today with this article, Tesla Wants Out of the Car Business, written by Patrick George. Elon Musk's grand vision is coming into focus. Elon Musk still makes some of America's best electric cars. Earlier this summer, I rented a brand new, updated Tesla Model Y, the first refresh to the electric SUV since it debuted in 2020. Compared with even just 2 years ago, when the Model Y became the world's best-selling car, many companies make great EVs now. Some of them have the Model Y beat in certain areas, but for the price, the Tesla is still the total package. Now, imagine how good Teslas could be if Musk apparently wasn't so bored with making them. With the exception of the struggling Cybertruck, Tesla hasn't released an entirely new electric car in 5 years. Musk has indicated that he wants Tesla to primarily focus on building robo-taxis and robots. Autonomous vehicle technology is the product that makes Tesla a $10 trillion company, he told his biographer, Walter Isaacson. People will be talking about this moment in 100 years. All the while, Tesla has continued to make almost all of its money from selling cars. But it's now clearer than ever that Tesla's future is not in selling cars. The company's latest Master Plan 4, which was released earlier this week, makes no mention of any new electric cars in the works. It is instead a technocratic fever dream, predicting a future in which humanoid robots made by Tesla free us from mundane tasks and create a utopia of sustainable abundance. To the extent that cars are mentioned at all, it's in the context of robo-taxis, or the batteries that power them. In other words, Tesla, the biggest EV company in the country, wants out of the car business. This new master plan, released on Musk's platform X, naturally, might be easy to ignore. The roughly 1,000-word document is exceedingly vague and includes language like this: "The hallmark of meritocracy is creating opportunities that enable each person to use their skills to accomplish whatever they imagine." Even Musk conceded on X that the plan needs, quote, "more specifics," end quote. But Tesla has released only 3 previous master plans since its founding in 2003, and generally they have paved the way for Tesla's future. The first one, published in 2006, laid out the path that Tesla would end up taking with its EVs. Start with an expensive electric car, then use the profits from that to branch out into more affordable ones. Nearly all of Tesla's competition still follows the same roadmap. Then, in 2016, Master Plan Part 2 stressed a deeper vision for more electric cars, including a future SUV that became the Model Y, and a brand new kind of pickup truck. And that one is pretty obvious today. If this week's master plan reflects a company that is dead set on moving beyond cars, the divergence started back around the time of that second report. Even in 2016, Musk envisions a future in which fully autonomous cars generated passive income for people while they worked or slept. The third master plan, released in 2023, is a 41-page white paper about the future of sustainable energy and how it could power fleets of autonomous vehicles. But the latest version is far more focused on AI than its predecessors were. Even just the visuals are telling. In one image in the master plan, a family plays Jenga on their coffee table while a Tesla robot waters the plants behind them. Right now, Musk has more of a reason than ever to go all in on robotics. Today's Tesla's board unveiled a new potential pay package for its CEO, promising him as much as $1 trillion. Yes, trillion. If he meets certain targets, including deploying millions of robots and robo-taxis in the next decade. Tesla did not respond to a request for comment. Granted, Musk is onto something here. Many in the auto industry believe that technologies such as electric power and autonomous driving will converge over time, which is why they're bullish on EVs in the long term. But Musk's view of that timeline is likely overly ambitious. Nobody's making any passive income from a self-driving Tesla, as Musk said they would by 2020. Even its driverless robo-taxi service is up and running in only Austin and San Francisco. Tesla is far behind Waymo, the driverless taxi service owned by Google's parent company, that is picking up riders in 5 cities and is quickly spreading to many more. Meanwhile, Tesla's humanoid Optimus robot is unproven, and the project has reportedly struggled with delays and leadership turnover. But by betting everything on AI, Tesla is sacrificing the very thing that the company knows how to make so well, cars. Autonomy has already come at the expense of new EVs. Last year, Musk reiterated that he feels it would be pointless to make a $25,000 car unless it was fully autonomous. Tesla could be financing its self-driving technology dreams by making that affordable EV or a more conventional pickup truck, but Musk seems to see that as some kind of distraction. If his master plan doesn't pan out, there won't be much left of Tesla. The company's sales have collapsed across the world, in part because of Musk's politics, and in part because Tesla is getting hammered by EV newcomers from China. The master plan doesn't outline any way forward. Musk has learned the hard way that making cars is a brutal business. The costs are high, and the profit margins are slim. Fighting over market share with Volkswagen and Ford isn't an expedient way to colonize Mars. But Tesla's retreat from the electric car business is everyone's loss. Tesla is a big reason that so many automakers have frantically begun to make EVs in the past few years. It showed the rest of the industry that if you build high-tech electric cars and they're actually good, people will buy them. Under Donald Trump, as incentives to make and sell EVs are vanishing, plenty of automakers in America are already walking back their once ambitious electric plans. If the biggest seller of EVs continues to move away from what it helped create, Americans will end up with cars that continue to pollute. That certainly doesn't get us to a world of sustainable abundance. Our second story, Tennis is the Ultimate Lifetime Sport, written by Alexandra Moe. The U.S. Open is one of the few occasions a year when tennis really gets its due in America. More than 1 million people, including Simone Biles, Aaron Judge, and other top athletes, shelled out for tickets last year. Feverish heat be damned. Ticket sales this year are up by 8%. The sold-out after-party, featuring the band Odessa, will transform New York's Louis Armstrong Stadium from tennis court to dance club. All of the pomp around the Open harkens back to tennis's history as an aristocratic leisure. The first precursor to the Open in 1881 was held on a grass court in Newport, Rhode Island, at the height of the Gilded Age. Instead of electronica, spectators were treated to a string quartet. But over the past half century, tennis has been dramatically democratized, the sport has been growing since the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, when hitting a ball outside 80 feet from anyone else seemed to be one of the healthiest exercise options available. Last year, more than 25 million Americans played. Tennis today unfolds predominantly on public courts. You might even have a middle school up the street where you can play. Just disregard the blue pickleball tape across the baseline. All you need is a racket, a ball, and one other person to return your serves. If you don't know how to hit, Venus Williams, the winner of 7 Grand Slams, can teach you a forehand on YouTube. All of that makes tennis a refreshingly easy sport to pick up. But its real advantage over other sports is what happens when you keep on playing. Tennis is a full-body workout. It not only builds muscles, but it also elevates your heart rate. It is notably more aerobically challenging than pickleball, which has, for the past few years, infringed on tennis's court space and crowded the zeitgeist. To reach the tennis ball before its fateful second bounce requires horsepower, and you're responsible for covering a lot of ground. More than double the pickleball plot. The tennis net is also, 2 inches higher at center court, making it harder to clear. Frequent tennis improves bone density, which staves off fractures and osteoporosis. Crucially, tennis is a lifetime sport. Two coaches describe their clients' age ranges to me as between 3 and 90, which means its benefits can last through middle age and into your elder years if you stick with it. Keeping with tennis over multiple decades was associated with a reduced risk of heart disease in men in a 2002 study. A Danish study from 2018 found that tennis players lived nearly a decade longer than their sedentary peers, and also longer than swimmers, cyclists, and joggers. No other sport in the analysis was correlated with such a large boost in life expectancy. Thanks to this study and others, the United States Tennis Association markets tennis as, quote, the world's healthiest sport, end quote. At its essence, tennis is about moving through space correctly, says John Rately, a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School and the author of Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. Receiving the ball, you gauge its trajectory, spin, speed, height of the bounce, while determining how to most efficiently reach it. Then, while running, racket outstretched, you decide how you'll return it, with a new angle, speed, and spin. Ideally, the chosen combination results in the ball landing inside the court and going to where your opponent is not. Also ideally, the racket, as directed by your body, follows your mind's split-second intention. You may even have to factor in the wind and the sun. The sport demands so much complex motor coordination as well as finesse that it carries the same cognitive balance and coordination benefits as dancing. You only need to watch videos of Roger Federer leaping and gliding across the court to realize how tennis approximates the quick step. Like any sport, of course, tennis can lead to injury. The most common ones involve sprained ankles, a sore back, torn shoulder cartilage, and weakened tendons, but it's remarkably low risk. In an Aspen Institute comparison of the 10 most popular high school team sports, tennis ranked first for safety, with infinitesimal rates of catastrophic injury and concussion. Tennis may even help stave off injury, especially for older players. Paul Wright, the chair of Nuvance Health's Neuroscience Institute, told me that if you can balance yourself on a tennis court, you're more likely to successfully negotiate obstacles at home, avoiding falls. Perhaps most important, tennis is a workout for the brain. Learning new skills, rock climbing, knitting, chess, can buffer against cognitive decline. In one 2023 study, older adults who were assigned to weekly skills classes developed working memory and attention levels typical of people decades their junior. But there's reason to expect that any tennis player, regardless of their level, can reap cognitive rewards. Racket sports require completing tasks in unusually rapid succession. Here comes the ball again, and again, at this new angle. You have to be on, Wright said. It should be no surprise, then, that prolonged tennis training has been shown to shorten reaction times. Among children, it's also been linked to enhanced decision-making. What's uniquely beneficial about tennis is that it's both highly complicated and highly aerobic. Any aerobic exercise can benefit the brain by improving mood, which in turn aids memory and cognition. Tennis, with its explosive bursts, sprinting to the ball, stopping, lunging laterally, jogging backwards to the baseline, can yield especially powerful results. James Gladstone, the chief of sports medicine at Mount Sinai's Icahn School of Medicine, told me that tennis resembles high-intensity interval training, which has been shown to improve cognitive function and memory in healthy older adults. In use, it has positive effects on cognitive performance and attention. If you want to pick up a sport, I submit that tennis wins in straight sets, not only because it boosts health, but also because hitting a ball and receiving it is a great time. Fun reduces stress, and the more stress you have, the more your body needs to move to keep your brain running smoothly, Rately wrote in Spark. Plus, if you enjoy an exercise, you'll do more of it and gain more health benefits. Several players described to me the addictive pleasure of striking the ball correctly, the popping sound of ground strokes, the satisfying release of driving the ball from the legs rather than the arms. Other players find that tennis's learning curve only stokes their interest. Mastering the sport takes years. That might sound intimidating, but to many it's motivation. Lawrence Barrett, age 89, has played tennis for nearly 70 years, dodging his son's entreaties to play pickleball. For one, he can't stand the high-pitched thwack of a plastic ball. On the morning that we spoke this spring, he had, by his own accounting, hit a few damn good volleys. For most of my life, I had swung a racket once a decade, aiming haphazardly and getting by with a rustic version of tennis. But a couple of years ago, I decided I would learn to hit a clean forehand that didn't sail skyward. I began taking lessons, soaking in key information such as, don't get too close to the dang ball. On YouTube, Williams taught me to move my shoulders as a unit in the forehand, so that when she appeared as a wild card at the DC Open last month, I bought a ticket. I showed up 2 days after the 45-year-old Williams had served 9 aces and defeated a woman nearly half her age. I watched as her forehand whipsawed the July humidity, her shoulders unlocking velocity and angles that were even more astonishing in person. How many hundreds of thousands of forehands had she hit throughout her lifetime? Watching her, I could only imagine playing the duration of mine. Our third story, when your kid's best friend is a great big problem. This is written by Russell Shaw. When I was 10, my best friend taught me how to make a flamethrower. We duct taped a can of WD-40 to one end of a 2x4, melted a candle onto the other, and prepared for imaginary enemy marauders. We never lit it, thankfully. If my parents had known, I wonder whether they would have forbidden the friendship. Though if they had, it might not have mattered. My pal and I still saw each other daily at school, where our recess schemes, such as building a roulette wheel from a broken turntable and getting classmates to gamble with the desserts from their lunches, mirrored our weekend mischief. The friendship died a natural death after sixth grade when we went to different schools. Now I'm an educator tasked with keeping an eye on creative, devious kids. And I know that as another school year begins, many parents are bracing for new friendships. Some welcome, some less so. Last spring, the distressed mother of a middle schooler sat in my office. "I feel like I've lost my daughter," she said. "Ever since she started hanging out with those girls, she's become a different person." She told me how her daughter had become obsessed with her appearance, was constantly on her phone, and had lied about doing her schoolwork. "I want to tell her she can't see them," the mother said, "but I'm afraid that will only make things worse." This conversation captures one of parenting's most agonizing predicaments. What do you do when you don't like your child's friends? The stakes can feel enormous. Peer influence is real and powerful, and it shifts dramatically during the teenage years. When children were young, they spend most of their time in smaller, more supervised worlds, at home with family and at school with teachers who keep a close eye on them. But as kids move into adolescence and gain more independence, friends start mattering more, filling the space previously held by parents and teachers. This shift isn't a sign of parental failure. It's a normal part of adolescent development as young people begin to separate from their family and form their own identity. Of course, knowing this doesn't make it any easier when your teen's friends seem to embody everything you've tried to teach them to avoid. Parents unhappy with their kids' friends typically contemplate two approaches: prohibition or passive resignation. Both are suboptimal. On the one hand, mandating separation from certain friends can backfire. Reactance theory posits that when people believe that their freedom is threatened, they frequently grow more motivated to pursue the forbidden activity or relationship. Tell a teenager that they can't see certain friends, and those relationships tend to become more appealing and influential than they would have been otherwise. I learned this lesson early in my career as a dean of new students. I had told two 11th graders who were engaged in an intense and, to my eyes, unhealthy relationship that I thought they should break it off. My well-intentioned meddling turned what might have been a casual teenage romance into an epic love story in their minds, with probably more drama than would have occurred if I had simply butted out. On the other hand, standing idly by while a kid makes concerning choices can feel like an abdication of parental responsibility. When a child adopts troubling behaviors, values, or attitudes, the typical instinct for caregivers is to intervene. How can we just watch kids make what we believe are poor decisions? The answer lies in understanding how influence actually works and playing a longer game than the one teenagers and their friends are playing. I have seen the subtle enduring power of parental influence up close. Consider a moment familiar to most educators. After months of a school struggling to support a student, the parents are called in for a meeting. As the meeting wraps, the educators look at one another and say simply, "Oh." Behind that "oh" is the realization that, whether the parents are aware of it or not, their child has adopted habits that mirror the parents' own. A third-grade boy has a hard time paying attention in class. In the meeting, his father skips from topic to topic, chasing thoughts like fireflies on a summer evening. A seventh-grade girl has iced out several of her former friends from a lunch table, leaving behind a trail of weeping, rattled classmates. In the meeting, her mom speaks witheringly about the other girls' mothers. In certain respects, this might take parents aback. Probably no one likes to think that they're having a negative influence on their child. But looked at another way, say in the context of what to do if you don't like your kids' friends, the fact that children unconsciously absorb so much from their parents should give many parents heart. Research from the developmental psychologist Lauren Steinberg indicates that although peers have enormous influence over adolescents' day-to-day choices, what to wear, what music to listen to, how to spend free time, parents can retain significant influence over their children's core values and major life decisions, including whom they choose to spend time with. But parents need to remember that they can't teach their values in a PowerPoint presentation. Instead, those values are taught in thousands of smaller moments. When they gossip at the dinner table about another family, or give up their seat on the metro for an older passenger, kids learn how to be in the world and how to make choices by watching their parents, not necessarily by listening to them. Take a mother I know whose 15-year-old son started spending time with a group that seemed to prioritize displays of material wealth in a way that made her uncomfortable. Rather than forbidding the friendship, she doubled down on family practices that reflect her values. She continued their tradition of volunteering together at a local food bank once a month. She made sure they still had device-free dinners where they talked about their day. She shared stories from her work as a pediatrician, not as lectures, but as natural parts of conversation. Just as crucial, she avoided making negative comments about her son's friends, which would have forced him to defend them and potentially identify more strongly with their values. One of the most effective strategies, for parents troubled by peer influence is to lengthen the gravitational pull of home. This doesn't mean vying with friends for your teenager's attention. Instead, it means making home a place where your kid and their friends generally want to be. In our household, we keep a cabinet drawer stocked with snacks, fruit roll-ups, Pringles, Pop-Tarts, an ever-present box of Lucky Charms. We consciously choose to sacrifice nutrition for a sense of welcome. Although our snack drawer is just one factor, we've had a steady stream of teenagers in our house over the past decade. If a child's friends are involved in illegal activities, substance abuse, or other behaviors dangerous to their health, more direct intervention may be necessary, but even then, these situations, outright prohibition is generally less effective than addressing the underlying problems making these relationships appealing. Sometimes teenagers gravitate towards risky peer groups because they're seeking excitement, belonging, or an escape from their own struggles. In these cases, helping a child find healthier ways to meet those needs, whether through sports, arts, community service, or other activities, can be more effective than simply trying to remove the bad influences. A parent's job isn't to control, but to remain a loving caregiver who ultimately trusts their child's capacity to make good choices. Sometimes that means watching them learn lessons the hard way, but it also means being there when they need a parent most, which is typically long after the friends who worried us so much have faded from the picture. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina